This is Democracy,
a podcast about the people of the United States,
a podcast about citizenship,
about engaging with politics and the world around you,
a podcast about educating yourself on today's important issues
and how to have a voice in what happens next.
Welcome to our new episode of This is Democracy. This week, we are going to talk about the role of radio communications during the Cold War and our contemporary international space, the ways in which radio communications from the United States, broadcasting information, news, updates on the world, and tracking events around the world, the way that has been so central to American policy and intellectual development over the last half century, and the challenges that we face today, challenges to the continued use of radios, the continued broadcasting of information, and the spread of factual, objective or near-objective news in a world so filled with misinformation and disinformation. We are joined by a good friend, leading scholar, and quite frankly, I think the best person in the world to talk about this topic, Dr. Mark Pomar. Mark is a senior fellow at the Clements Center for National Security at the University of Texas, and he has written extensively on this issue and worked extensively on this issue. Mark, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, I'm just delighted to be here.
Mark has had such a central role in our topic today. After teaching Russian studies at the University of Vermont for 7 years, he joined Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, and he was director of their Russian service in Munich, as well as director of the Soviet division of Voice of America, and the executive director of the Board for International Broadcasting, which was a federal agency overseeing Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty. From 1994 to 2008, he was the senior executive and president of IREX, which was one of the largest nonprofit organizations funding research in Russia and research about Russia. I was one of many recipients of IREX funding, so it was instrumental in my own research. And from 2008 to 2017, he was the founding CEO and president of the U.S.-Russia Foundation, which was a private U.S. foundation that supported educational programs, exchanges, and most importantly, bringing knowledge across boundaries between these societies. For all of you listening today, I encourage you also to read Mark's most recent book, which is really fantastic. It's very readable. It's based on state-of-the-art research, and it tells the story of Cold War Radio. That's the title. It's a wonderful title. Cold War Radio, the Russian broadcasts of the Voice of America and Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty, published in 2022 and available at every major bookstore. Right, Mark?
It certainly is. Actually available audiobooks as well.
Fantastic. So before we get into our discussion of the role of these important institutions and the role of broadcasting information during the Cold War and in the decades after the Cold War and its importance today, we have, of course, our scene-setting poem from Mr. Zachary Suri. Zachary, what's the title of your poem today?
Radio Liberty.
I think that's an appropriate title, don't you?
Yes.
Let's hear it.
Where the road ends, the line of trucks stops, and the barbed wire blooms like bougainvillea, you can still pick up the signal. You can still hear the voices whispering into the cold night. You can, when the night is still, walking by the fence, hear them on the other side, listening. On the borderline, someone is speaking in rhythms of red, white, blue, and America, and they are saying something simple. Perhaps it is true. This is freedom.
What's your poem about, Zachary?
My poem is about the sort of power of radio and of listening to the voices of Americans and American reporters and journalists and all these American-supported programs across the many sort of political, social boundaries that separate our world. In particular, it's a sort of imagining of what it might be like today if one were able to, in Russia or in somewhere in one of the sort of totalitarian countries of Eastern Europe, to listen to a sort of American radio program, sort of like right on the border, and how it's a sort of like bastion or breath of one world in another.
Yes, yes. Mark, what do you think?
Well, I am very, very impressed by the poem, and I think you've captured one of the most important symbols, and that is the crossing of the barbed wire that the radios were really created to do, to break down that iron curtain that Churchill so properly said had descended. And I will tell you an interesting story that kind of actualizes your poem, if I can. When the Cold War ended in 1989, when Hungary was among the first to really bring down the barbed wire, they gave all of us a piece of the barbed wire embedded in a kind of plastic that you could put on your bookshelf, memorializing the fact that the radios had helped bring down the barbed wire, the actual barbed wire itself. And I have that at home, and I will happily bring it and show it to you. Wow. And it's from Hungary, given to all of us as a personal gift.
Wow. Wow. Mark, take us back to the founding of these organizations. Voice of America, I think, is the oldest of them. Maybe tell us a little bit about that and then how Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty grew out of that or how they emerged as well.
Sure. Well, you know, in the 1930s, by the 1930s, every country had an external broadcaster, big or small, whether it was Radio Moscow, whether it was Radio France, whether it was Nazi Germany, whether it was Radio Canada, everyone had a broadcaster except the United States. And advisors came to President Roosevelt and said, you know, we need to set something up. And he hesitated because there's actually pressure from private broadcasters who wanted to dominate the shortwave broadcasting space. But once World War II started, once United States was attacked in Pearl Harbor, those plans were actualized very quickly. And of course, VOA was brought in as part of the war effort to tell our story. And I think what's very important to keep in mind is the first words of VOA spoken in German were, "We will tell you the news, whether it's good or whether it's bad. You will hear factual information," something along those lines, very nicely done. And what distinguished VOA was precisely that it would talk about military losses, which was then considered quite unheard of. It was really, I mean, we could go on and on about VOA in the early days, but it was really headed by a wonderful American playwright called Robert Sherwood, who was one of Roosevelt's speechwriters. Actually, I think the author of the Arsenal of Democracy that
right.
Roosevelt did. I believe Sherwood was the one who wrote that. And he really molded VOA into a liberal broadcaster in a very, very... And so we're skipping a little bit ahead, but VOA was very much attacked by McCarthy under McCarthyism as harboring all these dangerous Europeans and foreigners with all kinds of potentially leftist views and so forth. But there's some wonderful stories about VOA in the beginning. Yul Brynner, the actor Yul Brynner, worked for VOA. So did many of the correspondents who then went on to work for CBS and NBC. They got their start at VOA during the war. So I think the story of VOA really needs to be known much more.
Yes. And how did it provide that, shall we say, more objective reporting at a time of war when there must have been a lot of pressure to tell only one side of the story?
Well, it got itself into a certain amount of trouble because it sometimes broadcast things that neither the Roosevelt administration nor certainly the military wanted to have on the air. So there was always tension. And by the way, that tension continued all the way through VOA's history, that what it would put out was not always what either the White House or the Pentagon or whatever other entity wanted to be on the air.
And why was it allowed to do that? It, as you say, it was attacked. Voice of America was at times by McCarthy. It was attacked in the late 60s, sometimes by Richard Nixon and others. But yet it survived, at least until recently. How did it survive providing news that was not always in the interest of government, even though it was funded by government?
It had bipartisan support, for the most part, in Congress, which was very important. And also in the mid-1970s, President Ford signed sort of the charter and the law that embodied the fact that the VOA was the voice of the American nation, not of the administration. Mm-hmm. And I think that's very important to emphasize, so that, of course, every administration had its time in the sun, as it were, and they would their views would be presented. But the law incorporated what they called responsible discussion of those policies. And that would mean that other voices would be presented. So that when the president gave the State of the Union, the party out of power would always have its voice reflected in VOA broadcasts about the State of the Union. That was embedded. When Watergate, and this is very important, when Watergate broke, and I know this from many Soviet listeners who were very, very much impressed by this, VOA covered the Watergate no differently than did any of the news organizations. And to listeners at that time in the Soviet Union, to see the VOA broadcasting about the president and the scandal and what was going on no differently, having their correspondent on Capitol Hill following the testimony.
Yeah.
And I can skip ahead the two impeachment trials that took place in the first Trump administration were covered by VOA in Russian. Sure. I happened to sit and listen to them in my home, and they broadcast the testimony, the hearings, the voting. It was presented absolutely straight, even though at that time Trump was in the White House. So I think this is a tradition that goes way back. It has been supported at critical times. I'll give you another very vivid example of VOA. Those maybe listening who are older may recall that President Reagan made quite a blunder in 1984 when he thought that the microphone that he was testing his voice was dead, but it actually turned out to be a live microphone. And he said, "I've just canceled the Soviet Union. We're about to begin bombing in an hour." That made news everywhere in the United States on every
channel. I remember.
And we broadcasted in Russian on VOA just like everybody else. And I know that because the director, I was then the head of the USSR division at VOA, and my news chief called me up at home and says, "What do we do?" I mean, this is, in Russian to the Soviet Union. And I said, we have to do it. It's the law. I did call the director of VOA to inform him that this was, and he says, "Absolutely, this is what we need to do." Now, don't play it 100 times necessarily, but it has to go on the air.
Yes, yes. Zachary?
Yeah, it sounds like people abroad, and particularly in Europe, have a very strong impression of American media, like Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty. But could you explain for our American audience that maybe doesn't have the same sense of its importance what Radio Liberty and Radio Free Europe and Voice of America have meant for people in these countries?
Yes, thank you. I think that the creation of VOA was to really be the voice throughout the world of U.S. society, of music, of culture, of politics, and so forth. Radio Free Europe has a different sort of charge. It was really created with the start of the Cold War, interwoven with the Cold War as part of our effort to confront the Soviet Union. And it was addressed, and its origins really start, and it's very important to understand this, with the millions of people from Eastern, Central Europe, Soviet Union, who fled to the West during and after World War II. They were living in displaced persons camps throughout sort of the American sector in Germany. And George Kennan, who was really instrumental in creating both RFE and RL, and others as well, but he was more instrumental, and said, these are people we could put to use. They are eager to do something. Yeah. They have a lot of connections. Some, in the case of Czechoslovakia and Poland, had been in the governments before the, and in the Baltic states before World War II. And so RFE started first as a voice of Poland outside of Poland. So the idea being that you're in Munich, Germany, but you're creating a Polish broadcaster, as if you were sitting in downtown Warsaw. And the same would be true for Czechoslovakia, for Hungary, for Bulgaria, for Romania. That was the beginning of Radio Free Europe. That same model was used 3 years later to create Radio Liberty for the Soviet Union. And very important to note, not just in Russian, but in the different languages of the Soviet Union. You know, I like to remind my British friends that, you know, the BBC only broadcast in Russian, whereas RFERL, or RL in this case, Radio Liberty, broadcasts in Ukrainian, in Estonian, in Latvian, in Lithuanian, in Georgian, Armenian, Kazakh, Tatar Bashkir. You know, wow. I'll tell you, I was in Kazan, which is the capital of Tatarstan. This is obviously in the 90s. And I was introduced at this very important gathering that I had worked at Radio Liberty. And this man comes up to me and he says, "My parents listened to Tatar Bashkir. We didn't even know that Americans knew we existed, wow. let alone to be able to broadcast in that language."
That's quite
and
a
I
story.
Think it, and by the way, that has a whole very important tie to the whole decolonizing of the Soviet Union. Because what Radio Liberty did in particular was gave Ukrainians a voice, Belarusians a voice, Georgians, Armenians, that they would not have at a time when there was Russification throughout the Soviet Union.
Sure.
They kept alive a voice that otherwise would have been muffled.
In some ways, they became a substitute radio station for societies that couldn't have their own radio stations.
Exactly. They were used the term surrogate, which kind of has a harsh tone to me, but it was called surrogate radio. And the idea being, again, that you were presenting a lineup of news as if you were in that city. By the way, let me give you an example from yesterday. Now, we're jumping ahead. We're jumping ahead, I grant you. But Radio Liberty, VOA have all been closed. There's no money coming in. Radio Liberty and RFE broadcasters, they're in Prague, and there's a good story as to why they're in Prague, which we should get to. And they're working for free, and they're putting out only a website. There's nothing other than a website. And I looked at their news, and their news is what you would expect news to be in Moscow. I mean, in a freer Moscow.
So they're reporting on the Ukraine war.
So they had who was arrested for protesting the Ukrainian war in Russia. But they also had a whole thing on Alexander Ovechkin winning that. That was one of the lead stories.
Sure. Passing Wayne Gretzky for goals.
Yeah. They had a piece, very straightforward, totally objective, on the latest Trump discussions with over tariffs. They had, in other words, they had a lineup of things that a Russian would want to see, and that's really the core of it.
And why are they in Prague?
They are in Prague. It's an interesting story to start with. In 1992, 93, with the Clinton administration coming into power, there was a lot of discussion of, do we need the radios in general because the Cold War's ended and life is wonderful and who needs this very important tool of the Cold War? And the Clinton administration was quite ready to zero them out. And it was Václav Havel and Lech Walesa who really pleaded with Clinton that we need these radios
for a while. That's so interesting.
And Havel said, here is a gift to the American people, a building in downtown Prague to commemorate sort of your contribution to our freedom. We're giving it to the Americans for free. That won the day. And by the way, I can say that the bipartisan support led by Senator Joseph Biden, by the way, Biden was critical in bringing together the Republicans and the Democrats to support the continuation of the radios, but with the proviso that as countries graduated to free media, those services would close. So the Polish service closed, the Czech service closed, in time the Romanians, Estonians, Latvians, and it was idea behind it was that through analyzing and understanding the evolution of that when those countries no longer needed an outside domestic voice, then, of course, that would be the end of it. While they needed it, RFERL would continue to provide that. That was the understanding, and that's the way it has always been developed.
And just to clarify for our listeners, as Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty were doing their work in various places, Voice of America continues to broadcast at this time everywhere, basically.
It does, but in the case of the Russians, they put together something called Current Time, which is a joint sort of radio, because the budgets were cut so much that to sort of capitalize, each side did part of the program.
I see.
So you had a Current Time in Russian where the Prague office would tap into much more of what was happening in Europe, what was happening in Russia. And by the way, from 1991 to 2022, Radio Liberty had an office in Moscow. A functioning news bureau, doing interviews, running a normal news bureau as you would expect. It, of course, was closed with the war against Ukraine. But the coverage, of course, continued. The war in Ukraine was one of the big, big stories for the radios, both in Ukrainian and in Russian.
So it's quite clear, and you've certainly described this in great detail in your book, the ways in which the radios, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, and Voice of America, provided information to people in information-starved societies, places where they were restricted in their own media for what they could cover, how many people listened to it as a kind of samizdat, as a kind of secret way of getting around their own censor. Zachary refers to this in his poem. After the Cold War, when the radios continued to operate in different form in Russia, in Kazakhstan and various places like that, and continue to be used in new places. As I understand it, there was a Radio Cambodia, Radio Free Marti for Cuba, right?
And also for Iran. I think one of the things that we have to note is that the young people of Iran are listening to Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty in Farsi.
That's so
interesting. Very, very important part.
And that's my question. How do we measure their effect after the Cold War? How would you describe their influence?
Well, you could always do surveys, of course. Surveys became open. And as we did surveys in general, you could see that the listenership was greater than we had anticipated during the Cold War when you couldn't do surveys. I think, as nowadays, all media is niche media. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's very little that is gigantic in covering. But Radio Liberty, just to take that as an example, since I know it better, has always appealed to a certain urban educated listener. Because a lot of what Radio Liberty put on would be programs on history, religion, culture, arts, music. So it sort of was oriented toward an urban educated listener. But you mentioned something, Jeremy, that I think is very important to stress, and Zachary mentions that, of course, in his poem, and that is the sort of human rights dimension of it. And I want to come back to that because there's a great book. I'm giving a plug for Benjamin Nathan's book on the Soviet human rights movement.
It's a wonderful book.
And what he describes is what I would call the virtuous circle. And by that I mean human rights activists in their small Moscow apartments would put together petitions, pleas, they would have accounts of who had been arrested. Western correspondents would either broadcast, write about that in the West, or more often bring the documents, the samizdat, self-published documents, out of the Soviet Union. They would go to Radio Liberty, VOA, BBC, and they would be rebroadcast back into the country. So what was being discussed in a Moscow apartment all of a sudden was available throughout the entire country, which would then stimulate others in different republics to respond.
Sure.
And when arrests were made, when people were incarcerated, that information no longer was able to go broadly. Sakharov was known primarily because he was on Radio Liberty one way or another every day.
Right. So it's Andrei Sakharov, the great Soviet scientist and dissident, actually. Yeah.
So, I mean, it was that virtuous circle. Now, I will also say that, and this is something I'm working on another book, then I have a whole sort of chapter on that part, is the important role that Radio Liberty did for the Jewish emigration.
Yes, yes.
It was instrumental in sort of what was then called refuseniks, Jews that had wanted to emigrate to Israel or the West. They were denied the emigration visa, which you needed, but they also were fired from work. So they were in this no man's land in the Soviet Union. And that story is very much part of the Radio Liberty broadcast.
That's fantastic. I mean, so in essence, the radios are providing a distribution network
exactly.
for things that you couldn't distribute in these closed societies. Zachary?
What is the state of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, and Voice of America today? I know they're increasingly under threat. What does that look like? What are they able to do now? What are they not able to do?
I would say the tragedy is they've been shuttered. If you go on the VOA website, as I did this morning, the last entry is March 15th. There is nothing after March 15th. It is dead. People are either placed on leave, many have been fired. There is no VOA today.
First time since 1942.
First time since 1942. In the case of Radio Liberty, they won an injunction in court, a temporary restraining order, with the judge saying that they should be able to receive their funding. They have not received it. As my understanding is, today's news that I looked at was done by people doing it for free. In other words,
right.
dedicated.
What you saw on the web that you described a few minutes ago, yeah.
So it's that's it. We don't have a voice. We have basically today disarmed for nothing. We have, mind you, VOA combined, VOA, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Radio Free Asia, Middle East broadcasters. There are several entities to this. Basically have about 400 million weekly viewers, listeners, 400 million, a lot in Africa, a lot in Asia, Latin America. That's gone. We have left the entire global information space to China, to Russia, in the Middle East, to Iran. That's it.
There was a really interesting article in the New York Times a day or two ago. I'm sure you saw it, Mark, and I'm sure Zachary saw it as well, about the country of Cambodia.
Exactly.
And how the radios from the U.S. were basically the only source of news. And with those gone now, local journalists have no way to operate. We were not only providing information, we were providing a space for journalists to operate in a society that otherwise would not allow them to do that. And it's really quite extraordinary. Why, Mark, do you think there has been this attack of this magnitude on the radios? As you referred to earlier, it's not the first time. Joseph McCarthy attacked the radios, and as I referred to, Richard Nixon and others attacked them at times. Why now this degree of effort to close these entities, which, mind you, are pennies in the national budget? There's no real savings. Why?
I like to say that the entire budget of all the radios, and they're not really radios, they're media platforms, because they do podcasts, they do websites and so forth, the media platforms, the entire of everybody is about a quarter of the University of Texas Austin budget.
Wow.
They are under $1 billion for everything.
Wow.
So we are talking about literally pennies in terms of the U.S. budget. Why they've been attacked is, of course, part of a much bigger question as to why the Trump administration is closing the Wilson Center, why it's closing other institutions. So it's part of a broad attack on, well, bipartisan national institutions, I think. And in the case of the radios, I call them the radios, but really the media, I think their whole premise is that they are nonpartisan, or they are bipartisan, but preferably nonpartisan. And I think that is something that this administration, which is a topic that gets us onto other issues, is really not accepting and trying to destroy.
So you don't think they're opposed to the media platforms? They're opposed to media platforms that aren't their media platforms.
Exactly. But rather than trying to change it, they just want to close it.
Yeah, that's the surprising thing to me, that they don't do what most authoritarians do, which is stack the existing institutions. I mean, you're a scholar of Russia, as I am. Yeah. This has been the great achievement of Vladimir Putin, which is to take existing institutions and populate them with his cronies.
But that's a lot of work. And that would also, in the case of Voice of America, which is embedded in law to present all sides, you would run into essentially violating. I think that closing it is denying, it's the Voice of America belongs to all of us.
Yes.
BBC, it's like BBC. And I oftentimes told Americans, go on the website, listen to VOA, it's your...
Yeah,
it's your station. You should take pride in it. It belongs to all of us, and I think to close it down is not just a tragedy; it's a crime. It's a type of treason to deny our presence in the global information space.
Zachary, are young people, especially those like you who care about politics, but also are interested in the media? You're a journalist yourself, Zachary, writing for the Yale Daily News and involved, obviously, with this podcast and elsewhere. Do young people who are in this space, do they pay attention to this? Is this an important issue today for your generation?
I think so. I do think that certainly the question of media bias and what are important sort of reliable sources of news matters. But I also think that so many young people aren't aware of this history of the important role of VOA and RFE and all of the sort of important American media outlets around the world. And I think the challenge is to inform people about all the important work that's being done and all the holes that are being left now in media coverage around the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've oftentimes, partly because during the shortwave radio broadcast years, of course, VOA was very hard to listened to in the United States. And it was not intended for Americans.
Right.
It was intended overseas. Of course, once technology took over and you could watch it, listen to it, I really encouraged people to do it because it's calm, it's normal. The surveys I have seen of media, fact-based, very close to the center, VOA always came out pretty much next to AP. I mean, those were sort of the...
Right, the Associated Press. Yeah, no, I've done probably hundreds of interviews with VOA reporters, and I always found them actually very middle of the road, very attentive to facts over opinions, actually. Mark, we always like to close with a question about how this history that you've elucidated so well for us today, how this history can help us to think about actions we take today. What can we do to make this history not just part of our knowledge base, but part of our citizenship, part of what we do on a day-to-day basis? For those of our listeners who care about having an open, fact-based broadcasting of news to the world and see that as one of the roles of a democracy, especially a large democracy like ours, what can they do to help bring that back or protect that or promote that at a time when it's under attack?
Well, I think, first of all, supporting and knowing about these entities, media entities, and they're much more than just RFERL and VOA. It also is Radio Free Asia. It's also Middle East Broadcasting. Middle East Broadcasting being extremely important given what's going on in the Middle East. You definitely want to have an American, you know, presence there rather than Al Jazeera and others. I think supporting it. But in a broader sense, I am encouraging people, and I'm actually writing another book to encourage even more people to study the radios as part of American and world history. Mm-hmm. It is so rich in terms of scholarship. Mm-hmm. It so invites people to look and examine how we function, good or bad mistakes or no mistakes, but really it's part of it. Fortunately, the Hoover Institution has the entire RFERL archive, which would take several lifetimes to go through. But it's there, it's available, it's open. The Open Society archives in Budapest have tens and tens of thousands of broadcasts that you can dial up from your home and listen to in whatever language you happen to know. So I think it's there to be studied, there to be incorporated into our understanding of world history, American history, and that may lead to a greater appreciation for what has been done and what needs to be done.
Yes. I mean, what always inspires me, I've spent time, as you know, Mark, originally in the archive when it was in Budapest before it was moved to the Hoover Institution. I've worked in it at Hoover, and I've listened to many of the broadcasts, especially from key moments in the Cold War. And it's inspiring, I think, to hear, particularly for Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty, the various emigres covering news in their society, bringing a passion and a commitment to it, and innovating new ways to tell the stories of what's happening in their society. And I think for young journalists like Zachary and so many of our listeners, there's a lot we can learn from this, and there's a lot we can do, even within the constraints we face, to try to tell those stories and use the stories of the past to help inspire us to tell the stories today. We were talking about this earlier, Mark, you and I, before we came on, about what's really happening in Ukraine, for example. Yeah.
Very important. And the radios covered the war so extensively, I would always look at them every day as part of my daily sort of check on what's happening in the world, because they covered the front, they covered, and of course, Ukrainians would be able to, in Russian, explain very easily what they were doing. So I got it fresh from the front. So I think it's very important. But looking ahead, I think right now, it's saving institutions because they are disappearing right before our eyes, along with many other institutions, but they are among the victims of this administration.
So that's a call to action. And I think it's
definitely
a call to action,
is.
Not based on politics. What I respect so much about what you do, Mark, I really do respect this, is that you try to tell the story of the radios in a way that is historical and fact-based. You're not trying to promote one policy or another. You're promoting the most essential element of democracy, which is the fair distribution of information so people can make better decisions. You want an informed citizenry in the U.S. and in Russia and in Ukraine and elsewhere. And the United States has played a crucial role, as you've shown and discussed today, over about 80 years, encouraging and promoting and supporting the spread of real information, fact-based information, to audiences that were information-deprived. And if we get out of that business today, democracy is poorer, poorer at home.
Absolutely.
And poorer abroad.
Absolutely.
So all of us need to stand up for this, I think.
Yes, and I think coming back to Zachary's poem, it is freedom, it is the ability to express your views, and one of the things that I've emphasized in my work on the radios is that it values the individual freedom of every individual, the right to be express your views, the right to explore, the right to have a say in your country's governance.
Zachary, I think because we're closing on that note, this might be one of those special episodes where we read your poem a second time. Could you close us out with your poem, Zachary?
Sure. Where the road ends, the line of trucks stops, and the barbed wire blooms like bougainvillea. You can still pick up the signal. You can still hear the voices whispering into the cold night. You can, when the night is still, walking by the fence, hear them on the other side, listening. On the borderline, someone is speaking in rhythms of red, white, blue, and America, and they are saying something simple. Perhaps it is true. This is freedom. Mm.
Zachary, thank you for that moving poem that I think encapsulates so much of Mark's lifetime of work and contributions and the role of international broadcasting. Mark Pomar, thank you so much for joining us. I encourage our listeners to learn more about Mark and his work, especially reading his book, Cold War Radio. And I want to thank most of all our loyal listeners and subscribers to our Substack for joining us for this episode of This Is Democracy.
This podcast is produced by the Liberal Arts ITS Development Studio
and the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Texas at Austin.
The music in this episode was written and recorded by Harris Codini.
Stay tuned for a new episode every week.
You can find This Is Democracy on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube.
See you next time.